Welcome back to Catalysts in Conversation, presented by the National Association of School Psychologists. I am NASS President Peter Faustino. In the first few episodes of this podcast, we've been able to explore issues that directly impact the work of school psychologists, from policy battles surrounding social-emotional learning to understanding suicide risk for students with neurodevelopmental disorders and how school psychologists can support them. But today, I'm excited to talk a little about self-care and how school psychologists can prevent their own burnout. This is especially important right now as the needs for our services seem greater than ever before, and we're all stretched thin by the impact of workforce shortages. To dive right into this topic, I'm excited to speak with Dr. Sahar Youssef, a cognitive neuroscientist and faculty at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. Dr. Youssef is considered one of the world's leading experts on cognitive training and the science of productivity, and she runs the Becoming Superhuman Lab. She has been profiled in Forbes and the New York Times and also teaches one of the most popular MBA classes at Berkeley, which teaches busy professionals how to get their most important work done in less time and with less stress. We are very fortunate to have Dr. Youssef as the keynote speaker at NASP 2025 this past February at our annual convention in Seattle. And I'm excited to have her here on the podcast today to bring that learning to all NASP members. Sahar, thank you so much for being with us today.
Peter, I'm super excited to be with you today.
Sahar, we haven't spoken since your keynote at the convention, so I do need to share that the feedback from everyone in attendance was that it was so inspirational and educational, and I'm going to use the word transformational. But before I jump into that moment that we shared, for the listeners on the podcast today, can we start with the basics? Tell the listeners a little bit about the work that you do and how it teaches us or informs us about burnout, in particular, that whole sort of brain and thought process and what it looks like in the workplace, especially in a school environment, if you can.
Sure, happy to. So my work as a cognitive neuroscientist, working, I will say, at a business school, so it's really the practical application of that biology research, is all about focus, attention spans, productivity, but you can't get that without the flip side, which is optimized rest and high performance in that sort of avoiding burnout, actually optimizing and managing stress levels, so on and so forth. So the ethos of my lab is how can a human being get more done in less time with less stress? So I study how essentially the human brain actually works cognitively and how we can have both optimized rest, but also optimized learning and focus and distraction management. So burnout is very top of mind always, always, always for my lab.
Yeah, I love that because so often we're driven by that conversation of like, how do we do more? How do we optimize it? It feels like we don't talk about the rest part as being the other side of that coin. I appreciate hearing that. One of the powerful topics from your keynote in Seattle was the connection, I think, between neuroscience and the ways in which we engage with technology. I think probably one of my favorite moments from the keynote was, and I hope you noticed it too, that 6,000 attendees and probably all 2,000 who were virtual and watching you, they all took out their phones at a moment during the keynote and they switched their phones to grayscale. I showed you a minute ago how I'm still maintaining that on my own personal phone and device. Is that a typical reaction when you hear from people who are implementing these small changes in their lives?
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited and happy that you still have the grayscale on. That makes me so proud, Peter. You're practicing what you yourself preach, because I know we talked about this after the NASP keynote. So I'll say a few things here. I would push for every school psychologist in this country to begin to see themselves and respect themselves as emotional Olympic athletes. You all are truly carrying the weight, not only of yourselves and your own lives, personally and professionally, but you are truly carrying the emotional weight of your schools, of your students. It's a lot. It is a lot. The same way that if you were to look at a, let's say, an Olympian, right? A professional physical athlete, how important is their rest to their performance? It's critical. It's critical. Look into it. Look at how many hours are basketball players, football players, soccer players, how many hours a day these folks are sleeping, truly paying attention to everything they eat, how they rest. Their rest is as important as their training. But I see so many folks in this space. School psychologists don't necessarily immediately put themselves first. I know this whole ethos of put on your own oxygen mask by we hear on flights. And I know it's like, I totally get it. I kind of eye roll at that too. But bear with me. Bear with me, folks. If you don't put your oxygen mask on, you're like, for school psychologists in particular, you all are a subset of the amazing human population where it is so critical for you all to take this seriously. Because if you're not putting your oxygen masks on, you are truly raising the next generation of every single adult that will be running this country. We need, I implore, I am begging, I am begging. I know you all can't see me. My hands are together. I am begging you all to put your own oxygen mask on first, because if you don't, what ends up happening is burnout starts to set in. And you notice that day after day, you feel exhausted. You feel emotionally strained, that your bandwidth is lower than it was a few years ago. And that because your bandwidth is low, you can't bring yourself 100% to the students and to the job itself. Meeting the demands become a little harder. But here's the thing. I have the distinct honor and luxury of calling one of some of my closest friends, school psychologists, that I'll, of course, I won't name by name. I'll keep them anonymous. They would totally hate me if I outed them nationally. But first of all, amazing humans. I have no idea how you all do what you do. Okay. But second of all, I know you all, and I know you're going to end up putting the kids first. You're going to end up putting everybody else before yourself. And then what will be taken away from you is feeding yourself emotionally and meeting your own needs emotionally and taking care of yourselves at the end of the night over the weekends. And that's what I really want. That's the oxygen mask I'm talking about, because you're going to run yourself empty. And Peter, the thing you talked about that I talked about, and I think it was a swerve. I think it was unexpected. I think I got on stage and Peter, you like teed it up. You're like, we got to talk about burnout. And I was like, and we got on and I was like, we're talking about burnout. And we're talking about, by the way, that when burnout happens neurologically, your amygdala, which is your fear and anxiety center in the human brain, gets bigger physically, it grows in size. And the medial prefrontal cortex, the MPFC, which is the area right behind the forehead, which is responsible for your executive function and actually regulating and managing our emotions and our energy and our executive function, that area, guess what? Atrophies. It gets smaller and weaker. This is the unfortunate double-sided, coin of burnout. That's what's happening. But I think the swerve really was, wait, okay, what do we do about it? And I'm like, we got to talk about your phone use. And I saw the faces. Everyone's like, wait, what? And I'm like, we got to talk about doom scrolling. And Peter, I remember your teenagers were in the audience too. I saw their faces, like, wait, what? Like,
It was a curveball. Nobody saw that one coming. People were hiding their phones or looking up from their phones. But your advice was so practical. I mean, and first of all, I appreciate everything you just said in naming the work that school psychologists are doing. I think when we get feedback about this podcast and people from outside the profession name it the way you just did, it's this incredible feeling that they get, like someone sees me and they understand how hard this is, because I think you nailed it around the idea that the way we get led down this road is we just constantly put the kids first, and we need just little moments to pause for ourselves, I think, to recall that we have to protect ourselves. And you gave such great advice.
thank you. And I'm really just doubling down on the thing at present moment. What the research is showing us is our relationship with our devices, our relationship with our screens, our relationship with our notifications is the thing that is draining our ability to actually rest, rejuvenate, relax in the evenings and over the weekends. So what it feels like, and I talk, and by the way, this is what it feels like even for me. I'm a part of this too. It's It feels like we don't have the time. That's what it feels like. That's what the experience is. And I talk to my own friends, again, friends of mine who are school psychologists, and like, with what time? I know all the things. I gotta sleep, I gotta maybe exercise, maybe I gotta do all these things, I gotta relax, I gotta read my book, all the things that we know are like, oh, go quote unquote good for me. But with what time? I don't have the time for it. The thing is, we have this is the sneaky drain. Our phones are stealing hours away that could be there available to us to do with what. And by the way, that is your time. You do with that time whatever you want. That is your time. If you want to dance around your house, if you want to, like, honestly, though, if you actually do want to, like, watch a movie, then do it, but you do it with presence. And you know the difference between, like, on a Saturday, sinking into the couch and really watching a movie. Like, you romanticize it. You make popcorn, you get snacks, you sit on the couch. You're there, like olden times when you go to the movie theater. You know what I mean? Like the real, like, I'm treating myself to movie night, and you actually get to sink into it and make it a thing. That is so much more rejuvenating than the thing that I find is happening in almost every American household, is we're like still sitting on the couch, maybe watching something almost every day, but the phones are in our hands. So we're bouncing back and forth. I notice when a text comes in, I notice that, and this half paying attention. And by the way, the research, Peter, on this is called continuous partial attention, CPA. This is what's killing us. It's what's killing not only the kids, but us as adults. It's killing the parents. It's this half on, one foot always. Like, I'm checking immediately when I wake up. I check last thing before bed, and then I put my phone on the nightstand and I pass out. It's this never offness. I'm never present 100% in a place. I'm always connected. That's what I'm pushing back against.
Oh, there's so much to talk about. As you were sharing, I remembered one of the I'll call it like the mind body hack that you shared with the attendees around closing your eyes for 10 seconds can signal the brain that you're in a safe space and that you can relax. And I think you put it in a framework of like micro breaks throughout the day, but even larger, I just heard you talking about if you want to watch a movie, just be off your device and be sort of present in the moment. Those are all part of the digital hygiene. I have to share with listeners the moment you were very kind after the keynote to spend a little additional time having lunch together. And you know, I was sharing, we were talking about how powerful your message was. And I did, I sort of challenged you. I was like, all right, but come on, show me your phone. What does it look like? And it was amazing. Just getting into Instagram, you demonstrated for me, had more firewalls than the Pentagon has right now. I mean, you are living your research, no doubt. Are there other digital hygiene tricks or habits that you can share? Are there some we should prioritize more than others?
That made me more firewalls than the Pentagon. Honestly, with some of the leaks we've had in the Pentagon, that might not be saying much. But beside that point, because right now privacy is like such a thing. But you're right. I do, and it's I'm a real human. I too appreciate a meatball recipe on Instagram. I too love a cute puppy video. I mean, I'm a real, like, I do this research, but I will absolutely, without those firewalls in place, will find myself spending an hour and a half just doom scrolling on Instagram. And it's not that doomy, it's kind of fun. And I need the blocks in place. And I think this is, if I may, Peter, this is the part where I can tell you as a neuroscientist, is I want the narrative to not be about the guilt trip. Please, let's not make good digital hygiene and good digital habits like going on a run at 5 o'clock in the morning. Like, it's not the same thing.
Feel like another
I
burden,
mean, yeah, exactly. Like, full disclosure, I'm not the go on a run at 5 o'clock in the morning kind of human. Like, probably never go on a run. The running just in general, I don't, I'm saying, like, can we not put it on a pedestal? Like, it's not the pinnacle. Like, it's necessary. It's necessary. And the reason why the digital boundaries and guardrails are necessary is because of this thing, the elephant in the room that I think we are not talking about in our households, in corporate America, and in our schools. And that is that evil versions of people like me, and really, I don't mean evil, I don't think anyone is truly inherently evil, but whatever it may be, it's using science to make things addictive and sticky. And I have to tell you, the way our devices work, and by this, I don't just mean a phone. I'm not talking about TikTok, folks. I'm not talking about Snapchat. I'm talking about your email. I am literally talking about Gmail, Microsoft Outlook, Teams. I am talking about the news. I am talking about your iPad. I'm talking about a wearable watch. I'm talking about anything that can ring, ding, bump, or boop you is designed by people like myself to be as addictive as humanly possible. The reason why is because of the business model. We need to increase time on screen and time on platform. And the thing is, we've put these devices that are inherently addictive. And when, by the way, when I say addictive, can I just say, I'm not using the word addiction in an ethical or moral judgmental way. Addictive just means habit forming. You can also find gratitude addictive. I find, you know what I really, really love? A nice long hot shower. I find I'm totally addicted. It's my thing, right? Like, does that mean showers are, no, of course not. There's no judgment here, folks. But what I think we're not talking about is the fact that they are addictive, which means it begs the question, what does it look like for me to have a balanced relationship with it where I'm still getting a good deal out of this relationship? I'm still getting what I want to get out of it, which, by the way, for kids means I'm still getting the requisite social connection. I'm still using it to maybe coordinate after school activities and so on and so forth, and in real life events and social connection. And I'm learning things and but you know, all the things we want to do, but it's not out of hand. It's not out of hand. And for all of us, the school psychologists listening in, are you getting a good deal? We all, I'm not saying don't have Instagram. Peter saw, I have Instagram. I'm not like a Luddite that's like, get rid of all the tech. No, I've got it all. I've got it all. But you have to understand this stuff is like candy. And the same way that sugar is also, by the way, delicious, let me say so myself, it's delicious and totally addictive. But it does beg the question, if I want to at least attempt to be vaguely healthy, I got to think about, okay, wait, I got to wait for dessert after my meal. Like, like little things. Like, what does it look like for you to like not buy the Skittles? What does it look like for you to like put it a little further out of reach, or like whatever it may be? These are the things that I want, I hope, school psychologists, schools to be talking about, parents to be talking about with their kids. It's the fact that it's addictive for all of us, the adults included. So what does it look like to have moderation?
My fear is exactly what you just said, which is that notion of like because we know there is the potential for you use this word not yet in the podcast, but maybe in another conversation that we had around digital dependence. I think because there is this proclivity for digital dependence, people are just trying to ban it all, and they're really not learning to then have a healthy relationship the way you described. I also loved what you were just saying, that science led us down this road to where the devices are sticky. It made me realize science is going to lead us out of it as well. I mean, that's the only way we're going to get unstuck from the devices is using the science and the research that is coming out of your lab.
This is the hope. It's not just my lab. It's the lab. It's we're a growing few. We're a growing
Very
few.
good.
We're here to support and fight the good fight. But I will say it's a lot of it is learning. And I'll tell you what powers my own passion for this. It's not your fault that you find yourself doom scrolling. It's not the kids' fault either. So it's not fair to me that everyone is in this situation and they don't know how to get out. And I have to tell, and nobody has the time or the energy to go figure out all of the different ways. Everyone I talk to, the adults that I talk to about this, they're like, can you just tell me what to do? Because and we need a fat, we need an easy solution. We can't have like a multi-complicated, solution. We need it to be fast, we need it to be swift. And we do have solutions now, a few that, in the form of experiences and courses, not only for our student populations, but also for school psychologists. There are ways of actually addressing this, and it's becoming a growing problem. If I may, Peter, right now,
Please.
58% of Americans, which includes, by the way, 80% of those under 30 years old. So we're talking the young people. This is Gen Z. They've grown up. And they all admit and they worry. They say that they worry about how much they use their devices. This is huge. So this whole notion that we had, I think, a few years ago, where there was all this pushback, right? That it's like, no, but the kid, the we maybe we don't get it. Maybe we don't get it. The thing is, if Gen Z, like the students themselves, half of them are saying, no, actually, I would love a ban. 45% of Gen Z right now say that they will not be giving their own children one day cell phone access until they hit high school. If the kids themselves are saying, oh my gosh, this was a huge mistake, we gotta figure out some solutions together and we can't wait around for, federal,
As a
yeah.
no. And as a practitioner, I will tell you that when we talk to kids about their relationships with social media or cell phone or technology, they will often share back that they're worried about their parents or that their parents are modeling it. So, to your point, it's not as if this is a small sort of vulnerable population. We're all at risk. I mean, we've been naming school psychologists, but business professionals, educational professionals, all of us, anybody that has a smartphone in their hand, I think is at risk for this. So we have to heed that warning a bit. One other question related to this. I mean, you were just sharing some wonderful strategies, as well as the opportunity that there are courses, and we'll make some of those resources available, tied to the podcast as well. But I do think that many people have trouble sticking with some of the changes, right? They learn something, they love it initially, maybe it lasts for a few days, I hope, or a week or two, and then different demands start to kind of get put on them, and they almost revert to some old habits. Do you have any suggestions on how people can kind of adopt these strategies more permanently so that that takes hold a bit more?
Absolutely. And to answer this, I again go back to my love of candy and chocolate. It's the same thing, truly, Peter. I mean, you're laughing, but like, do you have, by the way, do you have a sweet tooth?
Dark chocolate is absolutely my weakness, my downfall. One a day, maybe more than one a day.
I'm with you on that one. And I have to say, like, I'm definitely less of a fancy adult here. I'm a milk chocolate count. I'm trying. I'm still trying to get myself into the like to be like, more of like, no. Come on, Sarah. We gotta go. We gotta go.
I read something that dark chocolate was healthy for your heart, and that is all I needed to hear to then double down on why I eat dark chocolate. So.
It's true. It's true. The cacao is actually really good for you. It's got lots of antioxidants. I'm trying to go darker and darker, but I have to say, like, my kryptonite, I'm a candy gal. I have a sweet tooth. So, like, yeah, it's my
To
kryptonite.
all of you listening in Hershey, Pennsylvania, send chocolate stat to Sahar.
I will, if I had a sign, it's like will work for chocolate. Like totally will. I'll call them out right now. A few years ago, Ferrero Rocher actually reached out to me to do intro, and I was like, literally, like, you don't even need to pay me. Like, you just send me some chocolate. And then they fell off the map. Ferrero, if you're listening, contact Peter and me. We'll work. We'll come and teach you about things. No, just jokes aside. But if we think about the nutrition model, right? This is going to be my pitch to as a mindset shift of making this stuff sticky. I like seriously, like can we all just be human together for a second? Unhealthy food, quote unquote unhealthy food, is kind of delicious. Like whatever flavor it is that you like, is that going to go away? Or at some point, are you going to reach some peak magic adulthood where you become the most amazing stoic version of yourself and you just are like, no, seriously, actually, I do just want a glass of water. And the steamed broccoli. And I actually don't even let, like, if that's you listening, by the way, and you're going on the 5 a.m. run, phenomenal. I'm not talking to you. Amazing. 1%. I'm talking to the
Tune
rest of
out now. It's the rest of you we want to talk to.
seriously. Yes. Which is like these things are delicious for a reason because of our palate. The reason why they're delicious to the human palate is because they impart energy. Back in the day, we didn't have pure energy in the form of glucose and a bunch of the and fat and salt and all of these carbohydrates readily available. Peter, you and I would have to work real hard to gather and hunt enough food and gather it all up. and actually make all of this stuff that we now have available at the drop of a hat, which means our bodies, our ancient brains and bodies, our ancient biology is wired to want to go after easy, fast, cheap ways of getting energy, which means when you are born, you're going to be wired to want things like candy and yummy things and carbohydrates, because it means survival, which means this, like, so that we have to do away with this whole judgment thing. We got to do away with the shame, the blame, the guilt tripping, the yada, yada, because you're wired that way. But
and that shame often only shuts down the conversations, I've noticed, to your point. And that is, like, we need these conversations more and more. But I interrupted. I apologize. Yeah.
No. That is exactly a phenomenal point. Is the shame is not doing anybody any favors here. So I'm talking about nutrition here, but I promise I'm going to swing this back around to digital dependence. On the topic of nutrition and, you know, like all of our attempts to generally speaking, try to be healthier and yada, yada, yada. There's a lot of guilt and shame that's, first of all, unnecessary. We can just do away with that and put that off to the side. Practically speaking, if you want to make quote unquote healthy eating sustainable as a habit and not keep yo-yoing and swinging back and forth, you know how what they say in that space, they say, you got to make it a lifestyle. You have to just accept and embrace the things that are your kryptonite. Try not to fully deprive yourself. You just got to figure out what moderation and balance looks like for you in your family, in your household, with your cultural context, right? Whatever that looks like for you, it needs to be something you talk about and you think about. Because if you don't talk about it and you don't think about it and you're just flying by the seat of your pants, like if I had it like my way and I wasn't thinking about it at all, you know where I'm going, Hershey, Pennsylvania. So got a one-way ticket and I'm not leaving. I'm like, I'm gonna be like I'm gonna be like that little kid in Willy Wonka. Like, for sure, why not? Totally. So like, it's because it's delicious and why not? So on the topic of digital dependence, we have to reframe this stuff and have it be, it is naturally addictive. Why? Because we are all biologically wired as pack animals. Social needs, folks, are fundamental needs. Our need for social connection and feeling connected to the greater collective is a fundamental need for survival, period, point blank. Food, water, general shelter, social connection. These are non-negotiables, and sleep, I will say. You can't function without sleep. You can't survive without sleep. But you cannot remove social connection from a human being. Really bad stuff happens. If you are an adult and you got to have lots of social connection throughout your developmental years, let's say, and you reach adulthood and I remove social connection from you, guess what happens? The brain starts to atrophy rapidly. It's premature aging starts to happen. Human beings are wired for social connection. So social media, email, WhatsApp, text messaging, Signal, I don't, whatever you call, whatever it is that's connecting you to the outside, reading the news, it's naturally addictive. And it's not a bad thing. Again, judgment, we're not doing the judgment thing. It's naturally addictive. Isn't that beautiful that we all want to be connected to each other? It's a beautiful thing. So because it is naturally addictive, we didn't used to live like this. Peter, you and I are old enough to remember when phones used to be corded things at home. But
yeah.
Cool. It's the same thing that's happened years before that with food being so easily accessible, sugar being so easily accessible. Back in the day, Peter, if you wanted sugar, I don't know if you've ever tried to get sugar out of a sugar cane, but I've had the distinct honor of doing this myself. It takes work. I was sweating. Sugar canes are hard. They're heavy. It takes a lot of work to get real sugar out of those things. But now I can just go buy it. So you have to understand social media, screen time, all of this stuff is just the equivalent of having candy available all the time. Can we not judge ourselves for wanting to be on them? So doom scrolling is a natural thing that's happening. It's all we as a society are just getting used to having it easily accessible all the time. And we're kind of having an addiction moment right now for normal, natural, expected reasons. Yeah. And I see all of a sudden this next generation waking up and saying, wait a minute, this something seems off. Everyone seems lonely, unhappy, not like disconnected oddly and lonely, even though you're hyper-connected all the time. Like something is not adding up here. And it's because if I did get to eat candy all day, I actually wouldn't be getting my nutrition, right? It's the same model, Peter. It's the same model. If all the connection you're getting, so now also talking about kids, if the majority of the connection they are receiving and giving and receiving is on their phones, they are not going to be really socially satisfied. It's not real nutrition. That real need isn't getting met. And because that need is still there and they're hungry for real social connection, guess what they're going to do? Get on
Find
it.
it again. That is a powerful analogy. I'm not an expert like you, but I've been reading as much as I can, and I'm not sure I've heard that parallel, and yet it matches perfectly, I think, with what children and families are experiencing. Would you say that young people then should be part of that conversation, recognizing where they're at? I mean, either using that analogy or even just talking about tech, right? How do the conversations sound with middle school, high school, college age kids? Because I think some of our listeners are clearly practitioners working or having those conversations. To what degree do we need children to sort of recognize that? And or can they sort of like reflect on what's happening and give advice for the habits and the changes to occur?
Absolutely, young people need to be a part of the conversation. And it cannot be this patronizing form, especially for the older kids, right? I will say this, I'll just give my opinion here.
Please.
I do think that phones ought to be, generally speaking, not available to middle schoolers and under. But I think once kids get to high school, we're talking about young adults here. And I, as a college professor, I'm a university professor, I really, really do not support the bell-to-bell, full ban on cell phones at the high school level. And the reason why is because we are not allowing our young adults, when they have the support systems in place of their parents at home, their families at home, they've got teachers, school psychologists, and the whole ecosystem at school that knows their name, that cares about them. They have all of the support structure around them. Now is the time for them to start figuring out what moderation looks like. So that what it, because if you ban it completely and they never get to figure out what their own moderation looks like and practice it, you drop them off at college and then I get to see them and they're one of hundreds in my classroom. I don't know their name. I'm not there to give them support. Nobody really is. And they're on their own and they've never had unadulterated access to cell phones and social media. And I'm telling you, it does not look pretty. They are not sleeping. They are coming in with very serious mental health issues. So I do not believe in so classroom bans, yes. When it's time for class, there shouldn't be a phone in sight. But bell to bell, meaning you pretty much say like you're just not allowed to have this because we don't trust you to figure out how to work this thing. That is what I don't support. So even by the way, like, and kids are smart. Are you kidding me? Kids in high school, they're selling magnets to get through the yonder pouches. The yonder pouches don't work, folks. They don't work. That's not enough. You can't just ban the things. That's like banning, come 16 years old, you want to ban sugar? They're just gonna go out and buy it. Half of them are driving people. They're gonna go out and buy it. Like, seriously, think about the conversations we also have with our kids around alcohol and drug use. Like, you have to at some point treat them like mini adult, and you have to say, listen, you're gonna see this stuff. So let's talk about what it looks like and the fact that it's addictive. And all the adults are even telling you it's addictive, which is why the programs that I support and that, you know, our lab at UC Berkeley supports and we endorse are the ones that include the high school students in the conversation. They include the middle school students in the conversation. The same way when we're teaching our kids about nutrition, do you just say, don't worry about the reason why, but you have to eat this? Of course not, because we're trying to raise them so that they can make their own good decisions later, right?
No, I you would think that by now we would recognize the idea that banning things with certain age groups just does not work, right? It's the whole idea of like, well, you know, I'm going to ban this at school or in our house, but I'm going to go to a friend's house and it's just going to be a free for all, you know? I mean, I think the idea of raising everyone's consciousness as well as developing and sharing those research-based habits is the only way we're going to get through this. I mean, and I think you said that incredibly well. Your research is so valuable at this moment in child development. I mean, and your advice about protecting not only children, but our own mental and physical health, I can't thank you enough. I mean, it is really around the idea of building resilience to all of these potential threats and preventing burnout. Sahar, if I may, with whatever limited time we have, we've been asking each of the guests on the podcast what they do with their own time to balance out their stress. And I think you hinted about a bunch of them, just naturally, but what sort of fills your cup? And what do you prioritize in your life that just sort of makes you feel great? You might even say your work and your research, but I think we're looking for any other passions that would help others.
Ooh, okay. So I was gonna say, I'm like, I am, by the way, truly, I am totally like behind the scenes an absolute nerd. So for me, I've like every week I kind of end up collecting a bunch of new articles and everything that I want to read. And that's what I gift myself, over the weekends is like a time to actually just sit down and like soak up new information. For
With
me,
the limited time I've spent with you, that is so true and authentic. I just want listeners, I'm reinforcing what she's saying, that that's not a pitch. That is absolutely who she is. So,
it's true. Well, because it's, I see it as play. So I'm a huge proponent of adult play. I don't think we should ever stop playing. So whatever play looks like to you, and there's no judgment ever. What does play look like for you? Seriously, when do you feel like a little kid? For me, I like learning new things and being exposed to new material. And it really could be like, honestly, anything. Like it's like it could all kinds of different things. So for me, that's my version of novelty and play and injecting that. I also will say I love to cook. So I will, like listen to music and I like to cook sort of like by myself and it's very meditative for me. I'm also a long-term meditator, so I meditate every single day. That is how I start my day. It just doesn't feel like I can bring my whole self to my life without beginning the day with a little bit of time for me. And that is my version of that. Even by the way, if it's a minute, it doesn't matter what this looks like. It could be chaotic. You can meditate in the shower. It doesn't like seriously. But I'd like to cook. And I like to really play. And that play is exposing myself to like all the amazing things that human beings are doing around the world. So that's how I ruminate.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you for sharing that. And I think I too like to cook, and I think when you use the word play, I think for people who do love to cook, it is very much like playing in the kitchen kind of thing. I mean, that is something about tapping into what people seem to enjoy about it kind of thing. So, Sahar, thank you. Thank you again to Dr. Sahar Youssef for this incredible conversation.
Thank you all so much, and stay in touch with me. I've absolutely loved the few folks that have messaged me after NASP. You all are amazing people, Peter. Y'all have an amazing community going on
We
here.
absolutely do. I will totally agree. I'm biased, and we have an incredible community, which I'm just so grateful to be a part of and to be leading this year. And the whole idea of this podcast was very much about I have the privilege of having some wonderful conversations with brilliant minds doing brilliant work. I wanted to share that with everybody who's listening. And so you gave them another gift today. So thank you, Sahar.
Welcome. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Thank you again to Dr. Sahar Youssef for this incredible conversation. I hope that school psychologists listening to this conversation will come away with a sense of empowerment and an understanding of the ways that they can engage in self-care to prevent burnout and help us better serve young people and families. That way, we can take this conversation and put it into action. This marks the last episode of Catalysts in Conversation, and I am so grateful to all of you for listening. I hope that these discussions were valuable to you in your practice as a school psychologist, or the opportunities to learn from experts whose work deeply aligns with our vision of helping children thrive at school, at home, and in life were valuable. One thing I've appreciated about this podcast was the opportunity to share conversations and moments that I have had during my presidency. I've had the privilege of serving as your NASP president and wanted to find ways, both big and small, to give back to members of this
I'm going to
remarkable.
interrupt you. Go back to one thing.
I can. Okay. One thing I've appreciated about this podcast was the opportunity to share conversations and moments that I've had during my presidency. I have had the privilege of serving as your NASP president and wanted to find ways, both big and small, to give back to members of this remarkable association. This year has been a gift for me, and I hope these conversations helped you feel included in that blessing. And I hope that this is something that resonated with you, our listeners. This has been Catalysts in Conversation. I hope you've enjoyed hearing these insightful dialogues with my guests as much as I've enjoyed speaking with them about these critical issues. I'm Peter Faustino. Thanks for listening.